Nighton Arena. Kevin MacDonald tells another real-life story in his new film, The Mauritanian. And Finian Collins explores the delights of the cello in his festival, Cellissimo. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The Oscar-winning Scottish filmmaker Kevin MacDonald is one of those uniquely talented directors who's as comfortable making a documentary as he is making a dramatic feature. Just a few months after releasing the documentary Life in a Day 2020, an unflinching account of how COVID impacted around the world, Kevin brings us the feature film The Mauritanian, which tells the true story of Mohamedou Oul Slahi, an electrical engineer who spent 14 years in Guantanamo Bay without ever being charged. The film stars Jodie Foster and Benedict Cumberbatch, with Taha Rahim playing Mohamedou himself. The Mauritanian will be released on Amazon Prime Video on April the 1st. And delighted to be joined by Kevin MacDonald to talk to us about the film. We did speak to you about Life in a Day 2020 just back in February, but great to have you back with us again this evening, Kevin.
Nice to be back. Nice to be a regular.
Yes, well, indeed, you're welcome anytime. And at the speed you make films, we could be talking to you in a couple of months again. At any rate, the Mauritanian, this story of a man who was detained in Guantanamo Bay, as I said, for a very long time without any charge. When it first crossed your desk, or the idea of making a film was first mooted, were you a little bit wary about taking on the project?
I was a bit wary because I didn't think there was any point in revisiting the war on terror unless we did it in a different way and unless we could make a film that would reach a wider audience, you know, not just speak to the already converted. And I read Mohamedou's book, which was called Guantanamo Diary, and I thought it was an amazing document because it's the only book written inside Guantanamo Bay. But I couldn't really see how to make a film out of it. And then the producer said, just speak to Mohamedou himself. And he lives in Mauritania, which, for those of you who don't know, and that's me and everybody else probably, but before this, Mauritania is on the west coast of Africa. It's a big chunk of the Sahara Desert. It's a huge country, but it's virtually unknown. So three million people in it. They're mostly, or they have until recently, been mostly nomadic people. And I spoke to him by Skype, and he was so not what I expected. You know, somebody who's been in Guantanamo for almost 15 years. He'd only been out for a year at that stage. And I thought I'd find an angry, bitter man. And instead, he was joyful and sweet and very, very funny. And also just incredibly intelligent and had interesting observations on his experience. And I thought, this is a character I want to make a film about.
As you said, there's a scene, I can't remember the specific moment it happens in the film, where he talks about the Arabic word for forgiveness and the Arabic word for free are both, it's the same word that means free and means forgiveness. And it really gives us an insight into the mind of this man and how he has actually coped with what he went through in Guantanamo Bay.
Yes, you see, in many ways, the film is, as surprising as it might sound, it's a very, really uplifting film, actually. It's a very inspirational film because it's really about injustice and the injustice that was meted out to, you know, totally innocent Muslim men who were caught up in the world on the war on terror, which was many, many thousands of them, and including, they reckon, about 85% of the people who ended up in Guantanamo. You know, those people experienced the absolute worst end of America. You know, there was no outlet for them to be able to speak to their families. There was no outlet for them to sort of request a lawyer to begin with. And so Mohamedou was treated terribly, but what he combated that by forgiving the people who mistreated him and who tortured him. And because he said to me, you know, that by forgiving them, I was able to set myself free. Otherwise, I was eaten up by rage and anger. Yeah. I thought there's something so wonderful and inspiring about that.
The other thing, there's a statistic that comes towards the end of the film as well. 779 prisoners, 8 convictions, three of which were overturned on appeal. That's an extraordinary statistic, just to give an idea of the sort of numbers that were involved. But you mentioned there, Kevin, this idea of, you know, speaking to a man in this situation. While you wouldn't excuse it, I'm sure, but did you somehow understand, given that the early events in the film are in 2002, were not even 12 months beyond 9/11 the point we get the beginning of the story, could you understand perhaps the rage, the emotions that had driven the type of treatment that was meted out in Guantanamo Bay, even though I'm not saying excuse it, but could you understand where that rage came from?
I 100% do. And so does Mahamadou, by the way. He understands why he was a suspect. He just doesn't understand why he wasn't treated in a fair way according to the law. Mm. And, you know, one of the most touching things about his story is that he talks about how, as a young man growing up in a dictatorship in Mauritania and then as a student in Germany, he admired American justice and he admired European justice because he thought, that's what I would like in my home country. That's what the Arab world needs, you know. And so when he arrived in Guantanamo, he actually was relieved. He thought, oh, thank goodness, I'm going to now be given the justice I deserve. But, you know, America was traumatized and that trauma went, you know, still ongoing, but I remember in the months and the immediate years after 9/11, how, you know, it was a subject you couldn't talk to Americans about. Any sort of argument that wasn't just pure agreement with their position was greeted with rage. And that's what happens, obviously, when people are traumatized, especially for America, because they'd never been attacked except for Pearl Harbor, you know, in their entire history. I think the British attacked them in 1815 or something, but then after that it was Pearl Harbor. So yeah, I can understand the trauma completely, but I think the intellectual theme of the film is about the importance of the rule of law and what happens when you sidestep it or break through it.
So enter Nancy Hollander, played by Jodie Foster, and Stuart Couch, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, again, two real life characters. The Nancy Hollander character, or person, did you know? She has defended so many people in impossible situations and really believes in the rule of law. The Stuart Couch story is kind of more interesting in some ways, in that the journey that he makes is quite extraordinary. One of his friends was in one of the planes that was flown into one of the Twin Towers.
He was the co-pilot. One of his best friends was the co-pilot on one of the planes that flew into the Twin Towers.
So you might understand where his attitudes might be coming from.
Absolutely. And you know, you see in this character that Benedict Cumberbatch plays, you see somebody who is, you know, Republican, right-wing Republican at that, an evangelical Christian, a military man through and through, and he's become a military lawyer, and he gets given the task of prosecuting this man who is suspected of recruiting some of the 9/11 terrorists.
Let's listen to a clip featuring him then, Cumberbatch as Stuart Couch, in a scene with Jodie Foster as Mahamadou's attorney Nancy Hollander, sparring with each other over what could be called a very tense beer, I think it's safe to say.
The law says you get open file discovery, and I want you to have discovery. That way, when I beat you, your client will have nothing to hide behind.
You sound very sure of that outcome.
You haven't seen what I've seen. Let me ask you, I understand everyone has a right to a defense, but doesn't it bother you at all, working for someone like this?
I'm not just defending him, I'm defending the rule of law.
How very Ignatian of you.
I didn't know that they studied the Jesuits in the Marine Law School.
We like to fully consider a problem before we blow it up.
My turn. Let me ask you. What if you're wrong?
We're not.
What if you are? You built this place. You abandoned all of your principles, all of your laws, and you were wrong.
And that's Jodie Foster and Benedict Cumberbatch there in a scene from Mauritanian, and director Kevin MacDonald speaking to me about it this evening. It really opens up. It's an important turning point in the film that the couch character has discovered certain things that are making him feel a little bit uncomfortable as well. I don't want to get lost in the legal morass, but you might explain, Kevin, what a memorandum for the record is. These are frightening things, MFRs as they're referred to.
Yes, I mean, you make a film like this, which is about, you know, the law and how it's bent, and you obviously have to go quite, you know, burrow quite deep into legalese. And what was one of our challenges in the film was kind of like, oh, you have all these acronyms, one of which is MFR. How do you explain which ones are important and which ones are just sort of wallpaper? And MFR is very important. MFR is the memorandum for the record. That is actually what is written down by a guard who is observing an interrogation. So when these interrogations were going on, and some of them devolved into torture, as we now know, notes of exactly what was happening and who was present were made by somebody on the other side of a bit of, you know, one-way mirror. And Couch is trying to find these original records of actually what happened. And that's his kind of mission in the film. And when he does finally find them, at the same time as Nancy Hollander gets her hands on something similar, he realizes that everything is not as it seems. And those documents, I mean, it's a film which, I guess, it's a legal thriller, and it tries to make documents sexy in some way.
Yeah, it is. Well, you do it because we see redacted documents, and then as we're seeing those documents being read, we're actually seeing, I presume, probably the more watchable, if that's a very bad choice of word, but the bits that you can manage to keep your eyes on, the torture that was meted out on Slahi and indeed others in Guantanamo, I suppose you had to go for probably in some ways, the lower end of that torture, some of the higher,
We had a lot of discussion about this. I mean, Mahamadou was probably the worst tortured person in Guantanamo. Because the more he denied having done anything, and because he was so clever and a bit of a smart aleck, to be honest, the more good excuses he had, the more they became convinced they were just excuses, and they got harder and harder and harder upon him. And so if you read his book, you see the sort of full range of what was meted out to him. In the film, we try to keep that to, you know, one little section of the film. And you know, there's a lot of debate amongst us about, you know, what can we show? We don't want this to be a film which an audience can sit through. And we decided in a way that what we would do is go very subjective, you know, go inside his head and try to represent the kind of effect it has on him psychologically more than actually the objective torture, you know, which we've seen before in films like Zero Dark Thirty. But in this case, it's very different because you've grown to know this character, and you've grown to learn about his past and all sorts of things, and then you see this happen to him. So it's deeply personal, and I think, you know, my aim in making this film was to make a film, as I said right at the beginning, that it was accessible to a wide audience, and it operates like a thriller, and which is entertaining, and it has some humour, as you hear from the Benedict Cumberbatch, Jodie Foster. But obviously, at the end of it, it is a serious. It's got a very serious point to make.
And an extraordinary moment must have been when Mahamadou Ould Slahi himself visited the set during filming. I presume nowhere near any of those days when you were filming the torturing scenes.
No, he wasn't there when we did that. But actually, for him to come back to our set, which was very closely modelled on what he had told us he'd experienced. So he had done little drawings for us of what his part of the prison looked like. So, because remember about Guantanamo is that it developed and developed and changed. And, you know, you see a lot of pictures online, and a lot of them are different periods of prison, or they're not actually the real prison. Whatever. So he identified for us, you know, this is what my cell looked like. And he'd do a drawing, he'd do approximate measurements, the colours, everything. And he was really concerned that the physical environment be represented properly, because he said that environment is a secret. Still to this day, it's a secret, and I want that to be seen by the world. But, you know, that side of the film was we were filming in Guantanamo when he, in doing some of the interrogation scenes, but not the torture scenes, when he came to visit us in South Africa. And he only lasted about half an hour. He couldn't stand it. It was too traumatizing for him. And he went home to his hotel, and I phoned him that night. And being, you know, Mohamedou, who's always very funny, I said to him, you know, are you okay? He said, oh, no, it was just, you know, it's incredibly boring, isn't it, watching an actor say the same lines over and over again. It's like you were torturing them, Kevin.
Yeah, it's a rather less harmful type of torture, though, to be fair.
Anyone who's been on a film set knows that, you know, the boredom can verge on torture at times.
Just before we finish up, Kevin, I mentioned this thing about real life stories. We spoke about it the last time we spoke as well, and how much you mentioned at that time how real life can be far more stranger than fiction, as we all know only too well. So a documentary about Oprah Winfrey on the way. Will it include a royal interview?
Unfortunately, I wasn't allowed in during that particular encounter. No, but I'm doing a film about her. It's very early stages. But I just think she's a fascinating person because she's affected our culture, particularly American culture, but world culture as well, so much. And yet, you know, we only really know about her what she has revealed in, you know, in her show. So she has given me permission to dig around and to, you know, talk to her, but also talk to all her friends and colleagues and whatever.
And find the equivalent of the memorandum for the record from the person who was sitting watching it happen. One thing I want to finish, I mean, I mentioned both Jodie Foster and Benedict Cumberbatch and their performances. We can't leave out Shailene Woodley, who plays Nancy Hollander's assistant, Terry Duncan. But really, the man who I want to finish with is Rahim. His performance as Mohamedou Ould-Salahi Taha Rahim, it's an extraordinary performance. He's charming, he's vulnerable, he's so many things. What a set of qualities he has.
He's an amazing actor, and he should be he should have got an Oscar nomination for it. He's on the BAFTA nominations, but he's not got an Oscar nomination. He should have. He's absolutely brilliant, and maybe some of your listeners might have seen him in a fantastic French film from 10 years ago called Un Prophète, A Prophet.
Yeah.
The kind of gangster film in prison where that was his first proper role, and he's amazing and mesmerizing in that. And I've known him sort of since then. We worked together, you know, shortly after that film. We've been friends since then. And yeah, this is a stand-up performance. People might have also seen him in the BBC series The Serpent.
Yes. Yeah, he was in there as well. Well, listen, lovely to speak with you again this evening, Kevin. I look forward to talking to you about the Oprah Winfrey documentary when that gets made, whenever that may be. There's probably other projects in the pipeline before that, though, are there?
No, that's the next one in line. I'm looking forward to it, and let's talk again.
Right, great. And listen, I will finish up with a clip of Taha Rahim, but great to speak with you, Kevin. Thanks for being with us this evening.
Lovely to chat. Bye-bye.
That's Kevin MacDonald there, director of The Mauritanian. And in this scene that we're about to hear from the film, Jodie Foster as Nancy Hollander tries to understand what has been happening in detention to her client, Mohamedou Ould-Salahi, played by Taha Rahim.
Why didn't you tell us?
They're nothing. Like fantasy, yeah. None of that happened.
You signed them.
They made me.
They made you as in they coerced you?
What do you think?
I don't know. You tell me. Did they coerce you? But you gotta tell me what happened, Mohamedou.
You asked me to set fire to this place, but I'm still sitting.
Then write it down. All right, that's what the pages are for. Write it down. You need to tell me the truth. You need to tell me what happened to you. I can't defend you. Do you understand that?
I don't need to tell you nothing. Whatever I say, it doesn't matter. This island, I'd die here. Outside, my family, my brother, their lives go on. Tara's life goes on. But me here, I'm like a statue. Now you will leave too, and your life will go on.
What the hell do you know about my life? This is it. This is my life. I spend my time in places like this helping people like you. That's what I do. But don't question my commitment to your case.
The case. The case. The case. You're not committed to me. A person! No. You think I'm guilty? Say it.
Tahar Rahim as Mahamudu Oud Slahi and Jodie Foster as Nancy Hollander there in that scene from The Mauritanian, directed by Kevin MacDonald. The film is available to stream on Amazon Prime Video from April 1st. Have it, the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, one of the solo cello suites as played there by the French cellist Mark Coppi. Mark will be at Kylemore Abbey in Connemara this Thursday evening, directing the Irish Chamber Orchestra on the opening night of a brand new cello festival, Cellissimo, Music for the Senses. And this week-long festival, brainchild of Music for Galway and Galway 2020, European Capital of Culture. Due to happen last year, but like so many cultural events, it had to be postponed for reasons we all know only too well at this stage. But Finian Collins, classical pianist and artistic director of Music for Galway, is with me now to talk more. Having listened to that piece of music, I feel almost stupid to ask you, what is it about the cello that speaks to us in a very, very particular way? How does it speak to you, Finian?
Well, good evening, Sean. It's very hard to put into words. It's just so noble, and it's so human sounding somehow in going down to those deep register. It's the range that it has, that it can go so low and so high. It never sounds shrill. It can be grumpy at times, but it's always noble, and it's just one of the most versatile instruments. It can sound so well on its own as it does there, but it also does brilliantly in groups with a huge number of combinations of instruments, with orchestra, with piano, with electronics. You know, it's just incredibly versatile, and to me, it seems like the perfect instrument for a festival.
Which surprises me to hear a pianist admit the versatility of another instrument, a lowly string instrument with but four strings and a bow.
I know, but look, I played the violin myself for many years as a youngster, and played in orchestras, and I love playing with other people, and of course the piano is my own instrument, but I look outwards, and I've always had a bit of a growth with the cello, so we are celebrating it.
Yeah, and hardly surprising then that Cellissimo would be one of the ideas you would have during your time with Music for Galway. The suite we heard, I think that's the first of the suites, isn't it? I think it's the G major suite.
It is the first movement of that suite.
As well, you're going to hear all six solo cello suites played over the period of the festival. Is that the plan? Within other programs?
Exactly. We have a series of six lunchtime concerts as part of the festival, starting on Friday at 1 o'clock, and they are each day then for the 6 days, and each day we'll hear one of the Bach solo suites paired with other pieces of the cellist's choice, so making it up to a program of about 45 minutes, and there's a big mix of contemporary music in there with the Bach to sort of really set it off. There's anybody from Kaya Sarriaho to Ligeti to Kortag to Dutilleux, to the 18th century composer Duport, Casado from Spain. So there's a huge variety of music in along with the Bach suites every day. So it's a lovely strand through the festival.
And Mark, then, who we heard there playing the suite, he in fact is involved with the Irish Chamber Orchestra this coming Thursday evening. What's he involved? What will he be playing there?
Well, Thursday is our big opening concert. We're terribly excited about it. It's with the Irish Chamber Orchestra. Mark will direct the orchestra, but will also perform from his cello. So he'll direct the orchestra in a performance of Haydn's glorious C major cello concerto. He will also be joined by the young Irish cellist Christopher Ellis, his former pupil, and they will play the Vivaldi concerto for two cellos and orchestra. And in the second half, we'll hear Tchaikovsky's short piece for cello and orchestra with Chris on the cello, and then Mark directs the orchestra in two orchestral works, Barber's Adagio for strings, well known to audiences all over the world, and Bartok's happy divertimento for strings. So a very celebratory program to kick off our festival. But it actually, the festival starts just before we have the Irish Chamber Orchestra on Thursday in Kylemore. We have the the unveiling, if you like, of the Galway cello, which is an instrument that we've had made for the festival, an instrument made of Galway woods primarily. And this has been made over the last 3 or 4 years. And we have commissioned Bill Whelan to write a new work for the cello, which the Headford cellist Naomi Beryl will perform right at the start of the festival, before the Irish Chamber Orchestra's performance. So this is a really special moment that we've been looking forward to for so long now. As you mentioned, the festival was postponed and now it's been reimagined online. And we're just we're so excited to hear the piece, the cello, and to celebrate this new instrument that we've brought into being.
And you're live streaming, obviously, rather than having an audience present. But will it will be performed live, and what we're listening to or watching online, if we're doing that, will be happening as we're watching it.
Yeah, now not every concert in the festival will be live streamed, but the Kyalmore Abbey Irish Chamber Orchestra concert is live streamed. There's a concert with Naomi Beryl the following night from the McLally Theatre live streamed. And then I'm performing all five of the Beethoven cello sonatas on Saturday night with five different cellists live from Clare Galway Castle. Then there are other concerts which have been pre-recorded. And there are many concerts which have been sent in to us from around Europe, from cellists who, because of the pandemic, haven't been able to travel and quarantine and do all that. So, for example, the closing concert with Misha Majski and his daughter Lily at the piano has been sent to us from Belgium. And it's been wonderful to receive these recitals, you know, coming into us over the last week or so from different parts of Europe, and really, in a sense, turning Galway into an even stronger European capital of culture, you know, receiving these beautiful, some of the Bach lunchtime recitals, for example, coming to us from gorgeous locations. So it gives great variety and a real international feel to the festival.
You mentioned the five sonatas for piano and cello. These are the Beethoven works. How does that fare in terms of how even-handed is he? Does one or other instrument take the lead there, or is it a pretty even-handed division of labour on the part of Beethoven?
Well, they are called sonatas for piano and cello, so that shows you where Beethoven's heart lay, in a sense. He did the same with his violin sonatas. It must have been the norm at the time to call them that. The piano parts are very demanding, I can tell you that. I would say that in the first two sonatas, which are early Beethoven, the Opus 5, that the piano parts are almost concertante-like in style at times. The piano really has a lot of flourishes and solo passages. As they mature then into the later works, it's very, very even writing, you'd have to say. There's an awful lot of dialogue back and forth. The cello has the melody, the piano has the melody, and then they intertwine together. And, you know, they go forward into the late period of Beethoven. The great thing about the cello sonatas of Beethoven is that you can really follow his career from his early days to late, because they go from his Opus 5 to his Opus 102. And they're a fascinating way to sort of hear his style evolve over those decades.
And I guess for you playing the five sonatas in that fashion, it must give you a great sense of that development to actually play them in order.
Absolutely. And you can hear the exuberance at the start of the first one. And then, you know, by the end, you really do feel that this is the very, very developed writing and the writing of a person who's lived through a lot of difficulties.
And I know that the online thing, obviously we all want to get back into concert halls and into venues where we can sit and listen and watch the music happening in front of us and feel the vibration of the music coming at us in a live type of way. But there are certain advantages, I would hazard to guess, at the online option. What are they for you?
Oh, they are. Yes. Well, one of the clear advantages to us is that our audience is now is limitless. I mean, anybody can watch these concerts from anywhere in the world as long as they have a half decent internet connection. You know, so that means that our audience is worldwide. There's no limit to the number of tickets we can sell for the concert events. We're not, you know, stuck at 100 capacity. It meant that we could look for venues as well, which, for example, Kyalmore Abbey or Portumna Castle or Clare Galway Castle. These are venues where you couldn't have a large orchestral concert. You couldn't have a lot of people because they're small venues, but they're beautiful places. And so it was an opportunity to say, well, look, we're online, we've no audience, where can we go that will really showcase the west of Ireland, and we'll have a beautiful backdrop, we'll look gorgeous, and we'll make it sound gorgeous. And so those are just some of the advantages of moving online, which we're all struggling to see these days as well.
And I guess the other aspect, as you mentioned, Misha Majski there and his daughter Lily on piano, Misha Majski on cello, the closing event on the 31st of March. This was recorded in their home country, so they didn't have to travel. They couldn't have travelled. I guess it would have been way too difficult to organise that for every musician that you wanted to have.
Exactly.
So we're going to finish up by listening to them introducing the Rachmaninoff vocalese. And I suppose if an instrument can sing. It certainly is the cello. Just introduce this piece for us, Finian, if you would, and I'll take it up underneath you as you do.
Sure. So this is actually a work that Rachmaninoff wrote for the Voice. But it's the only song that he wrote. It doesn't actually have a text. It's just it's sung to ah, and it's a glorious piece for the human voice. And many other instruments then have played it on their own instrument, and on the cello, it also sounds glorious with the piano and the cello intertwining the different melodies. So it's a really, really beautiful, romantic, luscious piece of music.
Misha Majski on the cello, his daughter Lily on piano. Sir of the Rachmaninoff vocalese for cello and piano, Misha Majski on cello, his daughter Lily on piano. Finian Collins speaking to us before that about Cellissimo, music for the senses. It runs from the 25th through to the 31st of March, and you can get further details on musicforgalway.ie. Canadian writer, filmmaker and actor David Cronenberg is the choice of my next guest, Patrick Chapman, in our Where Do I Begin slot for Tuesday evenings. The Fly, Dead Ringers, Videodrome, Crash and other films have seen Cronenberg explore the genres of horror and science fiction to make uncomfortable viewing for his audiences. Car crashes, interspecies morphing and gynecology all make for unnerving hosts for Cronenberg's take on body horror and the exploration of very serious themes as well. Patrick, first of all, it was The Fly, in fact, that first alerted you to the dark and unsettling world of David Cronenberg. When did you come across that film?
I saw it in 1986 when it came out, and it was one of those films where a light bulb moment and you go, this is my kind of thing. And I thought it was wonderful rom-com as well as being a horrific monster movie as well.
I haven't heard The Fly described as a rom-com too often.
It's sort of not a date movie, but it's about two people who fall in love, and it's an allegory for toxic relationships, really. It just happens to be that this gentleman has been mixed with the DNA of a fly, and, you know, the girlfriend has to save herself because there's no way the relationship can continue.
You say that The Fly kind of opened up the world of David Cronenberg to you. And what was it in that world that attracted you in?
Well, I'd always been interested in science fiction and horror. And the emotional content of the story was, I think, picked up on by a lot of critics at the time as well. It was one of his early films where the characters had real relationships that you could recognise. And they were played by Gina Davis and Jeff Goldblum, who were a couple at the time. So their chemistry kind of set that film on fire, really.
So that was the film that started you into the world of David Cronenberg. Mm. But in our slot where we asked the question, where do I begin with, you've given us three films, really, which fit into what we might refer to as classic Cronenberg body horror. Explain that term, body horror. It's a kind of a mix of genres in many ways, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's basically the idea, it's a form of horror which isn't really supernatural, though it can have science fiction elements. It deals in grotesque or disturbing mutations, infections and violations of the human body. And it's often in Cronenberg, it involves a merging of a creature and a human, and it's to the mutual benefit of both.
Is there a touch of, if you like, as old a set of stories as Ovid's Metamorphosis, it really coming into a very 20th century type of sensibility in the world of Cronenberg?
Well, that's actually a good observation because, yes, you could say that, like Brundel in The Fly turning into The Fly, or in Videodrome, Max Wren has his hallucinations where he finds a Betamax slot in his stomach and he puts a tape into it, you know, so... all sorts of metamorphoses happen in his work.
Yeah, and in fact, the first your first choice for us is Videodrome, which really is a cult classic. One of the first projects, Hollywood-backed projects of Cronenberg's.
Yeah, and he basically didn't compromise whatsoever with when he went to make a film in the mainstream. He always took himself there rather than and brought them with him. So he always managed somehow to create honest material that doesn't compromise. But this one is quite interesting because it's made in the pre-digital era. So the technology it involves, it's about a TV signal that can cause a tumor. And it's coached in, or it's cloaked in a program of extreme torture and violence. And the idea is of the people who've sent this out is that if you're sick enough to watch our program, you deserve to die. So it's an intriguing commentary on prurience and censorship, but also on the sort of double standards that a lot of fundamentalists have in these movies.
Let's have a listen to a clip then featuring Nikki Brand, played by Debbie Harry, and she's talking through the TV to Max, played by James Wood, guiding and encouraging him to go on to the next phase.
I'm here to guide you, Max. I've learned a lot since I last saw you. I've learned that death is not the end. I can help you.
I don't know where I am now. I'm having trouble finding my way around.
That's because you've gone just about as far as you can with the way things are. Videodrome still exists. It's very big, very complex. You've hurt them, but you haven't destroyed them. To do that, you have to go on to the next phase.
What phase is that?
Your body has already done a lot of changing, but that's only the beginning. The beginning of the new flesh. You have to go all the way now. A total transformation. Do you think you're ready?
I guess I am. How do we do it?
To become the new flesh, you first have to kill the old flesh. But don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to let your body die. Just come to me, Max. Come to Nikki.
Debbie Harry as Nikki Brand and James Wood as Max in that scene from Videodrome from David Cronenberg. And Patrick Chapman is with me this evening, author of the book Cronenberg, David Cronenberg, Every Movie, Every Star, to answer the question for us, where do I begin with David Cronenberg? Obviously, we get that tagline there, long live the new flesh. There's a kind of, there's a fundamentalist aspect to that, which I think you've touched on. But that title for the film, Videodrome, what is Cronenberg? What kind of critique do you think he was making about media? And while video wasn't exactly social media, you can kind of see it as the precursor to the type of social media that we're dealing with today.
Well, we now have more technology as an extension of our bodies today. Anyone who, you know, people forget that you need to be able to afford access to a computer to engage in this new society. But back then they had analog, so it's all videotapes and so on. And that actually increases the specialness of the film's aesthetic in the present day. But these people who are behind the signal in this movie trying to impose a new flesh are basically talking about a trope that's common in Cronenberg's work, which is that of creative destruction. And that is a creative act is a destructive act. So if you want to create something new, you have to kill off something that already exists. And that's quite a radical idea in some senses, because it's very year zero. And the long live the new flesh, like in The Fly, Brundle loses his old flesh and becomes a new thing. Or the characters, we'll get to them in a moment, in Dead Ringers have to do something radical to change themselves. Or earlier in his career, he had parasites taking over apartment buildings, and that was a happy thing for the parasite. So it's really a... uncompromising approach.
Yeah, you've touched on it there. That it was a happy thing for the parasite. How nihilistic is that vision? That vision, you know, that for something new to be created, something else must be destroyed. It's a, if you can look at that in a positive way, it does sound quite nihilistic, but not necessarily is it so.
Well, he's always said that from the point of view of the parasite, a widespread infection is a happy outcome, and it really does depend on changing your point of view. So, you know, that's why The Fly can be seen as a romance, and Videodrome can be seen as a comment on television as was back then. I mean, there's a character in it called Brian Oblivion, who doesn't... It's great because it's got an apostrophe after the O, so it's a wonderful Irish name. And he doesn't exist anymore except on videotape, because when he died, in the year before he died, he recorded himself saying a lot of things. And that is an avatar of basically a fake person, but the reality is his television. Mm. He only ever appears on television. And that prefigures us talking to each other on Zoom or Facebook or whatever it is. You can go years without meeting people who you interact with every day.
Yeah, and I suppose in some ways it prefigures a type of transhumanism, that type of idea as well. Dead Ringers then, your second choice, Patrick. You actually say that The Fly, the 1986 film, that was a kind of a gateway drug to Dead Ringers from 1988. Explain what you mean by that statement.
Because the aesthetic in The Fly is a lot more accessible in certain ways, but it contains all of Cronenberg's tropes and styles and the subjects he deals with. Dead Ringers is a much more austere film. It's beautifully shot. It's got wonderful cinematography by Peter Suschitzky, a brilliant score by Howard Shore, and it's got a remarkable performance by Jeremy Irons as the two brothers, Elliot and Beverly Mantle. And they used new technology to make that happen seamlessly. But the reason I think it comes to me after The Fly is, or The Viewer, is that... the characters aren't necessarily likable, but they're very relatable from a certain point of view. Again, that thing. I mean, one of them invents surgical instruments for operating on mutant women because he's off his head on drugs and he thinks that the women are wrong, the technology is right. So he has to reinvent his surgical instruments. They're gynecologists, by the way. I forgot to mention that. But the way you look at they're twins, but the tagline for the movie was one mind, two bodies, or two bodies, one mind. And that actually comes about in the film, that you see this progression, that they actually merge together emotionally at the end. And I think this film it's absolutely beautiful, but I think it's really disturbing for a lot of people to watch. So The Fly might be your gateway drug. Dead Ringers is something a little bit stronger.
Yeah, you see, you want to know where you're heading when you start watching Dead Ringers. Let's have a listen to a clip where the Mantel brothers, Beverly and Elliot, have a lunch date. Beverly introduces the actress Claire, played by Genevieve Bugeaud, to his brother, Elliot. But have they met before?
Well, Claire Niveau, this is my brother Elliot.
Hi, Claire.
I hope Bev's told you what a big fan I am of your movies.
No, he hasn't. As a matter of fact, he hasn't mentioned you at all.
Really? That's not very flattering. Well.
I feel such a fool, actually. I must be the only woman in town who doesn't know about the fabulous mental twins.
What are you drinking?
Nothing. I want to be very sober right at this moment. I want to be very clear. There really isn't any telling you apart, is there? Absolutely identical in every respect.
I'm actually a couple of millimeters taller.
I bet somebody who knew you both, how shall I put it, knew you both really well, could tell the difference, couldn't they? Without measuring your height, I mean.
What do you mean?
Well, Beverly's the sweet one, and you're the shit. Am I right?
This is some feisty lady you found, Beverly.
Let's be frank, okay, Elliot? Let's ease up on the bullshit for one moment. You can be honest with me. After all, I am laying both of you, aren't I?
Just hang on a minute.
It's a sweet little act you have. You soften them up with all that smarmy concern, and along comes Dracula here and polishes them off.
Actually, I was the one who fucked you first, but I gave you to my baby brother because you weren't very good.
Oh, what a pair. They're Beverly and Elliot. They're played by Jeremy Irons and Genevieve Bugeaud, the actress Claire, who they're both have out to dinner. It's an extraordinary scene. Patrick Chapman speaking to us this evening about David Cronenberg. It's an extraordinary scene, and what is extraordinary that you believe the Irons is two people there. Performance of great quality.
Absolutely, and he created mannerisms for each one, and he played them all, worked them out separately using the Alexander technique, So he worked on one character, then the other, as if they were two separate people.
And that Alexander technique being a kind of a physicalization, where he almost got a type of stature, or pose isn't quite the right word, but a stature for each a character that created a totally different person to the for the viewer.
That's right. He would step on the front of his feet for one character, on the back for others, so he'd give them a different walk and so on.
And I suppose the twins idea is classic Cronenberg territory, you know, the good guy, the bad guy.
Yeah, it does have its origin in his work, in things like Daryl Revok and people in Scanners, for instance. But I think it is based on a real story. A true story, but it's completely different. It takes that as a starting point for something that's really very personal to Cronenberg, I think.
All right, let's move on then, Patrick, to your third choice. Comes from 1996, Crash, based on the book of the same name by J.G. Ballard. Very much we're in a world of celebrity here. Death and morbid attitude to loss of life in car crashes. He really picks his subjects in a very Cronenberg way.
Well, he's one of those directors, and maybe the only director, who just went on from one allegedly unfilmable book to another. And he took Crash, people said it couldn't be done, and they weren't wrong, they weren't right, and he could do it. He also did Naked Lunch later on, and people said that was an unfilmable book, but he made a good go of that. Here you've got J.G. Ballard's book, which was a controversial book even at the time, 1973, about people who find their emotions so deadened they can only feel things by experiencing extreme events. And in this story, it's car crashes. They get sexually aroused by having car crashes or visiting sites of car crashes. And Vaughn, the bad guy, I think he's the trickster character in this. He restages famous car crashes, such as James Dean, and he was about to do another one when his stunt driver crashed. But in the book, he wants to die in a car crash with Elizabeth Taylor. In the film, that doesn't happen, but because Elizabeth Taylor is the wrong age for it anyway, and she was still alive, so it would have been very insensitive.
I wouldn't have thought insensitivity was at the top of Cronenberg's list of concerns.
Well, Vaughn is a sort of cult leader in the sense that he gathers acolytes around him and brings them into a world of car crashes. And again, this is techno-fetishism in the way that earlier Cronenberg films transform the body with parasites. Here the body is transformed by the technology of the car crash.
James Ballard is going to feature in this scene that I'm about to play a clip from. James Spader, playing the character Dr. Helen Remington, played by Holly Hunter, and they're visiting one of Vaughn's events, played by Elias Koteas, and he's reacting to famous car crashes, as you said, Patrick, including here the fatal crash of James Dean in his Porsche.
Is this part of the act, or are they really hurt?
I don't know. You can never be sure with Vaughn. This is his show.
Ralph Fudrick was thrown from the Porsche and spent a year in the hospital recovering from his injuries. Donald Turnipseed was found wandering around in a daze, but basically unhurt. James Dean died of a broken neck and became immortal.
Elias Koteas there as Vaughn, and Dr. Helen Remington, played by Holly Hunter, James Ballard, played by James Spader, in that scene from Crash, the third of the three films that Patrick Chapman is sending us to in terms of getting us in touch with the world of David Cronenberg. Again, what I remember of this film, Patrick, is the physical pain almost. I found myself at times not able to watch the sort of things that were being shown to me on screen. It caused quite a controversy at Cannes when it was shown there.
But they always boo things at Cannes. The jury wanted to give it an award, but Francis Coppola, who was the jury president, didn't want to be associated with it. He thought it was awful. So they went around him and gave it a special jury prize for audacity. And Coppola wouldn't give the award in person to Cronenberg because he hated the film. So, and it hasn't stopped being controversial, I think. But one of the funny parts of the reaction to it is that Virginia Bottomley, I think Heritage Secretary in London at the time, put pressure on Westminster Council to ban it. And they did. So you can't see it in Westminster, but you can walk down Shaftesbury Avenue to Camden and watch it there.
As long as it's within your 5K at the moment, yeah, if there were a cinema open for you to go and see it. Finally, what did Ballard, the novelist, what did he think of Cronenberg's take on his own book?
Well, he was the unusual author who thinks the film is better than the book. And he thought it was much more powerful and dynamic. And he basically said Cronenberg improved the story by making a film of it. And he said it was terrific.
But does that tell us something about Cronenberg's ability as a person of the cinema to take, you know, the written word? Because so often it's a disaster, isn't it? When something is moved from the page to the screen. What was that quality that Cronenberg had that made him capable of doing, or has, that makes him capable of doing that?
Well, everything he makes, he does it for himself. He makes his own work of a piece of a novel if he's adapting a book. He's done so many of them now, but a good example of that is Naked Lunch, where he agreed that the book was unfilmable. So he took pieces of Burroughs's life and mixed those in with bits of the book. So he adapted it into a new medium rather than simply transposed it.
Yet another metamorphosis, I suppose we could say, to go back to our original theme. So that's your pathway, your suggested pathway for us through the works of David Cronenberg: Videodrome, then Dead Ringers, and then Crash. But be ready for all of them, I think we should say to everybody. Thanks for speaking to us this evening, Patrick.
Welcome.
That's Patrick Chapman, and Patrick's book on Cronenberg is called David Cronenberg, Every Movie, Every Star. It's published by Sonic Bond Publishing. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Sound supervision this evening was by Heather Carney. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. I will be with you once again, 7 o'clock here tomorrow night on RT Radio 1. If you want to listen back to anything, by the way, on the programme, you can go to our website, rte.ie/radio1/arena, an archive of all of our interviews within that particular web page. Lots of very interesting stuff there.